Thank you. All right, so we'll get started. The topic of tonight is really just to review some of the Pesach questions relating to this year. Some of them are specific to this Pesach season. Some of them are recurring Pesach questions that I thought were worthy of addressing. So we'll go one by one. I flagged, six different topics, and some of them we can spend more time on, some less time on, but I don't plan on exceeding the hour, so we'll see what we end up covering. So one question that arose this year was that it was determined that, you know, when you buy flowers, which is very nice, the Shabbos and Yantiv, you bring home flowers, that there's this little packet that usually comes inside a flower food, and you're always very worried that if you don't open it up and pour it in, then the flowers kind of wilt and die immediately. So you have to take care of that, figure out how to open it up without the powder just falling all over the place and getting all over the food in the kitchen and whatever. So it's a whole big exercise, but it turns out that there's a chashash chametz with respect to the standard flour food that you would buy. So if you bought flours on Pesach and you put in the flour food, you're not going to eat the flour food, but there's an issur of hana. You're not allowed to get any benefit from a chametz on Pesach. So is there, well, it's actually, it wouldn't be. Meaning that basically what the flour food is, according to the research that our kashrus staff with the meticulous investigation that was conducted by Rabbi David Cohn, it turns out that it's basically dextrose and sugar mixed with some minor ingredients that are actually potentially derived from chametz. And chances are that they're derived from kidneys. Kidneys, like corn syrup, things like that, would not be a problem of getting hana on Pesach. And that's, we have a minna that we don't eat kidneys on Pesach, but you're certainly allowed to benefit from kidneys on Pesach. But there is a small chance, it's a very minor chance, but remember, chametz is a very significant iser, so we worry even about minor possibilities. There's a minor chance that this dextrose sugar is derived from ingredients that are really chametz. And if they are derived from chametz, then really the entire flour food concoction, and not just a little bit of it, but the entire concoction would be chametz. The whole thing would be considered to be chametz. It would be potentially an issur d'oraisa. You say, well, it's probably not a kizayis. So, well, even chatzi shir, it's a chacham tzvi, chatzi shir, asa min haTorah might only apply to issur achila. This is also an issur achila. It's actually, and it might, we don't necessarily only hold like the chacham tzvi, but the truth of the matter is that we like to do taste tests, as people are aware, at the CRC, and according to our taste test, this is actually edible. It's actually perfectly edible. People don't generally have an interest in consuming the flour food, but if you did, it actually is something that would not be repulsive to the human palate. So, it's a very serious concern. Now, the truth of the matter is that there is a possibility of bittul, but the bittul would need to take place prior to Pesach, because you can't be mevatel chometz on Pesach itself, because it's an iser mashehu, it doesn't work, and it starts out as an iser hana, it's not going to go away. But what if I have chometz that became batel before Pesach? So take a look at source 1, this is in Simen Tuf Mem Zayin, Sif Dalin and Shulchan Aruch, and the sari of a chometz kodem a Pesach. If I had a little bit of chametz and it got mixed in to a non-chametz mixture before Pesach and it became batel b'shishim, that it didn't have any chance of conveying any time anymore because it was in nisbatel b'shishim, 60 times its amount, eino chozer v'neiva Pesach l'asov b'mashu. So this, you could breathe maybe a little bit of a sigh of relief. It's not going to become revived on Pesach. On Pesach you'll say, well, who cares if it became batel? I had a little bit of chametz there, and the chametz is going to be also b'mashehu. That's only on Pesach itself. If it became batel before Pesach, it does not get revived. So far, so good, until you get to the next two words, which is b'yesh cholkin. But there are those who disagree. So there are those who disagree. Maybe we have to be machlir. So which is the shita that we really follow? So fortunately, comes along the Ramah, And the Mama says, "V'nogin k'svara harishona." But we do really practice the first opinion. We practice according to the first opinion. B'chol taru b'shehu balach. As long as it's a liquid mixture where there aren't like little pieces of chametz that are going to be mixed in. Like you might have a baby food formula where the baby food is produced in a plant that also, even though this baby food might be kidneyous or might be completely a kosher lePesach, but there's a little bit of a flake of another the type of baby food that has chametz that's in the same facility, and one of the flakes happens to wander into this cereal. So even though it's only one flake and it's going to be buttoned all the other flakes, but it's a tangible thing. It's a tangible mashihu thing that you can pick up and put in your mouth. So that, since it's not a lach balach, that's not something which is completely dissolved. So we hold that would actually get resurrected on Pesach if you had some sort of a chometz flake. So therefore, that's why the Rama continues and says, Umiyu bidavar yavish nisari voshiyish lachos letaruvis. If there is some sort of a flaky thing, there's a tangible piece of chometz that got mixed into a combination of some other food. Like I had a roll of bread that fell into the wine. The wine is kosher lePesach. The roll of bread, you know, clearly is not. So and then if I pull out the roll, there might still be a little crumb. It's not discernible, but there might be a crumb there in the wine. So that's not lach bolach, because there could be a crumb there. That's going to be osu b'Pesach. The chayshin and shem nisharo bo peru menostin tam b'Pesach. Because I'm worried that there's going to be a crumb over there, which is going to still be tangible on Pesach. Says the Mishnah Berura. This is a source too. Shu lach bolach kigon. What's an example of lach bolach? Kigon sheicha shenisar b'yayin. That I have some beer, which is chometz, that got mixed with wine. Well, that's okay, because I can't pick out a particle of beer. So if I have a little bit of beer that got mixed into wine that is 60 times more than the amount of the beer. So that's considered to be gamke mikri lach balach. It's not going to be resuscitated for Isser on Pesach, and therefore that's going to be perfectly okay. He adds, the Mishnah Berura, that even though normally we say that bittul takes place at the time of Yediyas HaTaruvis, when you find out that there had been some sort of an Isser that got mixed in, that's when the bittul takes place. So let's say you only found out that the beer got mixed into the wine on Pesach itself. So we have a kula over here. It's okay. We say it's automatic bittul. Afilu lo noda taruvis ad Pesach. Gam kein amrina dekvar nisbatil. So it would follow, according to this, that just like, I'll give you another example. If you have milk that's not specifically identified as kosher lePesach, but you bought the milk prior to Pesach, so you'll say, and it has an OU, whatever you say, but it doesn't say OUP. You say, what could possibly be, or has a CRC, better yet, what could possibly be wrong with milk? What chametz is in milk? So there's a whole big discussion about what if the cow was only fed on chametz and milked on Pesach. That's a totally different discussion that some were concerned about, many were not concerned about, but there actually is a real concern halakhically, which is that there's actual chametz, not just that that the milk comes from a cow that was fed completely on chametz, which is a separate discussion, but there could be actual chametz in the milk, because you look at the ingredients of milk, it's not 100% pure milk. They put in vitamins. Sometimes the vitamins could contain a teeny tiny little bit of chametz. Now that teeny tiny little bit of chametz that it might be derived from, these vitamins, it's going to dissolve inside of the milk, and it's going to be 100% batel before Pesach. No problem. That's definitely lach balach. You're not going to take a particle of chametz outside of those out of those vitamins and put it in your mouth on Pesach. So therefore, many of the kashrus agencies recommend you either get milk, which it was 100%, you know, properly supervised kosher Pesach, where all the vitamins have been 100% vetted as well. If you're going to buy milk during Pesach, but if you're going to use milk that has not been vetted, so then you should not buy milk that has not been certified as kosher lePesach during Pesach itself. You should only buy it prior to Pesach, because in the event that there were these vitamins that were put in, they would have become batel before Pesach, and therefore they're not going to be revived or resuscitated or regenerated on Pesach itself.
For instance, on the first day of Chol HaMoed, with regarding milk, so on the first day of Chol HaMoed, you go into the store, I mean, there's still called, quote unquote, regular milk, as opposed to OUP milk, mm-hmm. but that, you know, was there before Pesach started, because of the extra.
Ah, so if it was there before Pesach started, so according to what the Mishnah Berurah said, if you don't know that, to Rubis out of Pesach, even if it wasn't known about until Pesach itself, it should probably still be okay. But you have to make sure that this happened before Pesach. Mm-hmm. It can't be like really, really fresh milk. Okay. You're going to get it. So therefore, it's generally, most of the kashrus agency just say, if you're going to get such milk, you should buy it before Pesach, just to be completely on the safe side. Yes?
Do the Hashgachot companies actually go on Chol HaMoed Pesach to check these things, or is all of the stuff that's labeled kosher to Pesach produced before Pesach?
So, it's a good question. So I do believe that when they certify something as kosher to Pesach, so it means that they've determined that everything was 100%. Or it was 100%, it was done before Pesach and it became batel before Pesach. And now, if you take a look in the Mishnah Berurah, I'm sorry, yeah?
Does Tam trump Shishin here? I mean, does Tam trump Shishin? In other words, with the beer and the yayin, I can see beer has a strong taste. If you taste it, even though it's Shishin, is that...
No, the assumption is, if I have Shishin, I'm not going to... Right, it's not a vidal time, I'm not worried about that. Right, okay. Yes.
The stuff that's certified for Pesach, there's nothing to be batel, right? They certified it that there was...
Right. If you can't trust kashrus agencies, who can you trust? Now, if you look at source 3 over here, Mishnah Berurah says that it's going to be usher for Pesach if, in fact, I have some combination where there was a flaky thing, that some bread that fell into wine. But even then, and this is what's helpful in our flour food story, because in the flour food story, it's pretty clear that this is like a lach balach combination, that whatever would be put into the water itself, if you had placed the flour food in the water before Pesach, it would have to be even before the time in which the chumash becomes also b'hana on Erev Pesach. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this would have to happen, but if you did make sure to put the flour food in the water, so there's not going to be any flake. But even in that case, if it would be a flaky situation, so the Mishnah Berurah says, Haim l'shtoso, that it's only a problem of actually imbibing it, of amutah b'hana, but it would be permitted to receive benefit as long as there was some sort of a bittul that took place before Pesach, or before the time that it became also b'hana and erev Pesach. So then you would be allowed to keep it in your home and get hana from it. Came into Shurak Kshash B'yama, because it's only a kshasha anyway, maybe you'll put this tiny flake of chametz by mistake into your mouth, so we're not worried, certainly, if it's something that you're not going to consume. So therefore, when it came to the flour food, we figured that however you're going to view it, and I think it's a lach balach situation, if you're going to pour the flour food into water, because there's nothing flaky, everything just dissolves completely into water once you put in the flour food, at that point, as long as you do it before Erev Pesach, or before the time the chametz becomes asa b'hana on Erev Pesach, so then there should be bittul, and you should be okay if you're buying flowers before Pesach. But if you're going to buy flowers past that point in time, like you're buying flowers midday or in the afternoon on Erev Pesach, so what we advise is that you should make sure, don't bring home the flour food. You just say, when you're taking out the flowers, you say, I'm sorry, I'm going to leave this flour food for somebody. Somebody else can have a double portion of flour food. You're going to be very, very nice. And maybe you can even ask for a discount, say, you know, I'm not getting the flour food, so maybe the flour should be half price in my case, you know, something. You know, you try to work something out. But you should not bring home the flour food. So therefore, this is our official CRC recommendation. People should avoid using the flour packets on Pesach or after the time of burning chametz on Erev Pesach, but it is perfectly fine to put the flour food into water before Erev Pesach or before the time of burning chametz on Erev Pesach, and then to keep the flours in the water combination on Pesach itself. So okay, just
okay,
a new chumrah of the year from the CRC.
You got to dump it in the toilet, though. You don't want to dump it in the sink.
Yes, if you're going, if you end up with it and you have to do Bi'ur Chametz, so dump it in the toilet. Yes.
So if someone
don't mix it up in your seder.
Yeah, so someone is coming for your seder and they don't show up until 6 o'clock or whatever.
And they say, "Guess what? I brought flowers."
Yeah, right.
So make sure that you don't bring the flower food into the house.
Just talk it to the garden.
Right. If they're going to bring you the flowers and they haven't already put it in the vase for you and everything else, which is often the case, and it comes with the flower food, so yes, you got it. You should get rid of the flower food because at that point in time, it's actually potentially. I'm not saying for sure. It's only a minor chance that it's chametz dry, but there is a slight chance, so therefore, you should get rid of it. Yes, 100%. Okay, very good. Now. On to the next topic. So, if you look at a source, this is a category based, Dunkin' Donuts, the Motzei Pesach. So, one of the time-honored customs here in Chicago is when Pesach ends, so you have to show the only reason you are refraining from chametz is because of the Yisro and Pesach, but therefore, it is an inyan, as soon as Pesach ends, you want to immediately go and grab some chametz. So, where are you going to go? And there's going to be chametz immediately available, obviously at the local Dunkin' Donuts. Assuming that you're not so 100% makbin of Chalav Yisrael, whatever, but you're going to go to the Dunkin' Donuts, very, very popular place on Motzei Pesach. Now, most of the time, even on Motzei Shabbos, you go to a Dunkin' Donuts, you're not so worried about, they made something for me on Shabbos, and now I'm getting hana from something that was specifically cooked or baked for a Jew for Motzei Shabbos. Why aren't we so worried about that? Because Dunkin' Donuts serves the entire community, and it's not really being prepared specifically for the Jewish community. There isn't like a mad rush Motzei Shabbos that they know that the majority of the clientele is necessarily going to be Jewish, but one time of the year in which there really is, I would say, a significant possibility and probability that the majority of the clientele is going to be Jewish is Motzei Pesach. So what about everything that's prepared on the 8th day of Pesach itself that is being made from chametz, and now you're showing up and you're eating the donuts, or you're eating the bagels, or you're eating the croissants. I'm not talking about the coffee. My stomach, the coffee is okay. Lach balach. I don't know. What story you want to give, though? Obviously, it's not cookable on Pesach itself. But whatever, it's probably not going to be a chametz concern per se. But what about with respect to everything else? So take a look at the chametz items. Take a look at the Shulchan Aruch, source one here in category base. Hilchos Shabbos Siman Shin Chaf Vav Sif Yud Gimel. Irish Yisrael. She saw the enemy Yudim Darim Bo. This is a Shabbos rule. If I have a bathhouse that is heated up on Shabbos, if most of the people in the town are non-Jews, no problem. It's being heated up in the non-Jews. You're not getting benefit from something that was being done that you couldn't do, that was being done for your benefit on Shabbos. But if the majority of the inhabitants of the town are Jewish, even if it's 50-50, so then you have to wait for what we call the day shiyase. You have to wait the amount of time that it would have taken to heat up the bathhouse. You're not benefiting from that malacha on Shabbos itself. Says the Mishnah Berurah, Mo'beinim Yehudim, he says, it doesn't mean that I measure the majority of the people in the entire city. What I do is as follows. Ein tali brov di yirei ha'ir, ela ba'anashim ha'regim l'chos me'chatzeh. I look at what's the population when the majority of people are going to be using this bathhouse on Motzei Shabbos. It could be the majority of the people in the city are non-Jewish, but if I know that on Motzei Shabbos most of the customers are Jewish, that means that it's being heated up for the Jewish customers and then they have to wait this period of time. Beis hazu, Shemotzei Shabbos, the Mestaba Daitin Mechame Mesamechas. Because you have to assume that it's based on the customer base that it is expected to show up, that they are heating up at the bathhouse. And Mishnah Berurah explains in Shaar HaTzion, how do I know that? Said because of the fifth chelik of Shulchan Aruch, common sense. Came near a pashut, the tali d'fi ha'eis, that it all depends on the specific time that we're talking about. So if we would apply these principles, I asked my kashrus staff, this is going back a while ago, a discussion that we had last this September, I said, wait a second, this is sort of like an interesting thing. When we consider this, halacha, isn't there a presumption that whatever is being prepared especially in terms of even the cooking, baking of chametz items on the last day of Pesach is being prepared for the majority of the customers of Motzei Pesach who are going to in fact be Jewish. And therefore, do we have to worry about this Bichdei Shiyasu issue? The kosher staff kind of did a little bit of research into exactly how long it takes to prepare the various items, or whether they're preparing it all together. A lot of, like the donuts, for example, are not prepared there in-house. They're prepared in a large commissary, which is not specifically geared for a particular Dunkin' Donuts. It's shipped from the commissary to multiple stores, and therefore much of the preparation is done beforehand. Maybe there's a little bit of a reheating or something like that, but it might be different with respect to, let's say, the bagels or the croissants. So what about also the fact that you're allowed to cook on the eighth day of Pesach? It's not like Shabbos. Shabbos, you're not allowed to cook. Yes, so you're allowed to cook and bake, but first of all, you're not allowed to cook and bake for after Yontif. You can only cook and bake on Yontif for Yontif itself. And secondly, you're not allowed to cook or bake chumetz. That's not something that you're allowed to do, even if it's Yontif. So therefore, it seemed to me that this would still be a concern. So according to our research, for those who are considering going as soon as Yontif is over, heading over there, so the donuts come in fully ready to eat. They just need to be thawed and decorated. There's only one type of donut that's an exception, which it takes 3 minutes to bake at the store. So chances are, as long as you're going to Davin Mariv, if you're going to race straight for Mariv, you have to make Havdalah, or you listen to Havdalah, and she'll find you, and then you're racing the Dunkin' Donuts, it's probably going to be 3 minutes. You're going to be okay with respect to the donuts. Donuts, you're probably going to be okay.
Their kids or people out of the house before they pack up the Pesach stuff in the boxes.
That's true. It's very, very true. That's right. Our people are going to go straight
there.
Right, right. And it could be a nice long line when you get there, but the long line runs to your benefit. Then by the time you get there, you're going to be okay. The bagels take about 30 to 35 minutes to bake at the store. The croissants take about 25 to 30 minutes to bake at the store. And there's another consideration as well that Rabbi Eisenbach pointed out, which is that it's very likely that because they want everything to be fresh, that a lot of the preparations might not even start until Pesach is actually over. So you have sort of that additional sniff lahakil. But just to be on the safe side, I would say that make sure, especially if you're going to be getting a bagel, that it's like at least 35 minutes after taste. Somebody, you know, asked me at the CRC, well, can we count at the beginning of Tseis according to the Vilna Gaon or the Gaonim? So you don't have to follow the routine. Once you're keeping Pesach, you want to do everything 100%, you know, perfectly. So I would say, you know, follow a Moshe Shiur, the 50 minutes, and then count 30, 35 minutes from there. So this is sort of my next Kumbah of the year. Right. Okay, so this we didn't necessarily advertise, because again, it's a very, very small shash. But nonetheless, I thought I would mention this as well.
What? They used to actually make the donuts at the store. Rabbi Shandalov used to announce when he was in charge of kashrus. He used to say 30 minutes.
Very good. You see, that, you know what? So Rabbi Shandalov was a go nuts, and that's all I could say. Yeah.
Does the kavana of the producers at all impact on this?
Well, I think yes and no.
A lot of retail things want to have fresh coffee or things like that, and they pride themselves on having hot coffee or things like that. So whether there's Jews there or non-Jews is totally irrelevant for their procedures.
Right, but the amount that's being produced is probably going to be relevant for their procedures. They're going to produce more if they expect more customers, and if there's customers they expect are in fact in the Jewish community, so then it's going to be relevant. So even though this is their MO, this is what they always do, but what they do is they make sure that they have enough for the anticipated customers, and this is the one night in which the majority of the anticipated customers are probably going to be Jewish.
The point here is, if the procedure changes for the producers to accommodate an expected larger group of Jews, then all these halachos become relevant.
Exactly.
But if they're making the same amount all the time...
If they're making the same amount all the time...
Even if you had, say, it's a Shabbos and you have... the hotel is for all Jews, but they produced hot coffee regardless of who's there, that would...
It's a good point. And then I think you probably follow just the majority of the inhabitants of the city again. But again, when you're heating up the washhouse case, or the bathhouse case, we're not necessarily talking about that you're heating it up in a different measure. But still, you wouldn't be heating it up altogether if the people would not be arriving. Well, so we assume that it's for the majority of
the
clients.
The heating up of the bathhouses is done specifically for the customers themselves. But if you heat the place regardless of who shows up, then that changes.
Look, I hear that. That's why I think that it might be a different cheshbon, as I said, with respect to the donuts that are made in this commissary, without necessarily having the Jewish community in mind. Right, okay.
Would there be any issue against buying a bagel 2 minutes after Pesach and then just not eating it for a half hour? Is the issue on the buying or the eating?
Yeah, you can buy. No, it's on the eating. It's on the eating. You can buy it 2 minutes. Yes, because there's no issur hana at this. Well, there's no issur of ownership, I should say. It's not like a ba'yiro, ba'yimatzeh kind of thing.
Okay.
So it's just that you wait b'tei shiasu before you're going to actually consume it.
So you can actually beat the lines even if you buy in too soon.
Potentially. Yeah. I think it stands to reason that it has to do with the consumption once we're talking about after Pesach. I think so. Okay. Yes. Okay. So it's a good question, though. All right. Now, the next thing I wanted to discuss, so this relates to everybody sort of, I guess, indirectly, which is the supervision that we do of the sale of chametz by a number of different companies. So there was always the question, you have like a supermarket, for example, that's owned by Jews and they sell the chametz, but they continue to operate on Pesach itself. Is that considered to be a legitimate sale? It's become an issue nowadays, not necessarily solely with respect to the supermarkets that are owned exclusively by Jews, but even if you have a minority ownership or significant minority ownership, so that also can become a problem over Pesach, because even though there is an opinion, the Zeche Yitzchak, the Panavisharov, that you go only after the majority, a number of the poskim say that it's not really true, that if somebody has, let's say, a significant interest, that if they, in the company, in terms of their ownership, that they could really dictate or have a voice in terms of company policy. So there's a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein that's in source form, page 2, in the Eben Ezra, Chelek Aleph, Siman Zayin, at least with respect to a company that does business on Shabbos, and you're worried about you own shares in that company, so are you guilty of facilitating work on Shabbos or even getting profits from Sechar Shabbos? So Moshe Feinstein says that if you don't have a significant voice in the company, then even if you have voting rights in the company, it's just considered like you have a share necessarily in the avoda of the company. You have a share in the dividends and the losses of the company, but you're not considered to be a real owner. And that tshuva by Rav Moshe is relied upon by many. The Minchas Yitzchak, Dayan Weiss, Zatzal in Eretz Yisrael, as a hero in Chelek Gimel Siman Aleph of his tshuvos, that he thought that it all depends upon whether there's a voting rights. But Rav Moshe says voting rights are pitume mili bi'alma. That's just to make you feel good and important. So you own shares in something and you get a prospectus in the mail, which is like 300 pages. So that you feel, oh, they're sending me 300 pages. They must really, you know, value my judgment. But most people just kind of look for the recycling bin because they recognize that it's not like what they say really, really matters. So Rav Moshe says, however, that if you do have significant share, so then it makes a big difference.
Well, what is significant share?
A significant share means that if you would raise your voice as to what the policy that should be followed by the company, they would take your view seriously. That's basically the way that Rav Moshe describes it. And some of these companies, and we had this issue with Jewel, for example, there's a sale which is conducted every single year by the OU. But the issue in Jewel was that there was a significant minority interest held by a Jewish owner, and therefore would sort of fall under Rav Moshe's criteria. But then you have the question about, okay, so let's say that this is a Jewish owner who owns either the majority of the company, where we would assume that for sure you would need to have the sale, or even a significant minority of the company that satisfies Rav Moshe's criteria. Let's say that the chometz is sold, and then the business continues to be conducted as usual. And this Jewish owner is still going to be deriving profits from the sale and so forth. So does that render the sale null and void? Because if it was really sold to the non-Jew, why aren't the profits going to the non-Jew? Why are they going to this Jewish owner? So there is an opinion of Rav Asher Weiss in the Minchas Asher who says, well, whenever you have a company, a corporation that owns chametz, it's not considered like any individual owns chametz because we consider the corporation to be like an artificial person, and it's just the corporation that owns everything, not the people themselves. And he says that's because normally if you have ownership, so you would have an equity ownership in something, you would have the ability to run it on a day-to-day basis and to make major decisions. But when it comes to a company, those three functions of ownership are spread out over three different entities. You have the shareholders who are the equity owners, you have the CEO who's responsible for the day-to-day decisions, and you have the board of directors that are responsible for mergers, acquisitions, major decisions of the company, and therefore it says there isn't real ownership, and you look at source one on the bottom of page one. So partnership would be a different story. Partnership, then, that would follow the general rules that we described, that if it's Jewish, the majority partner is Jewish, so for sure that would be a problem. Minority partner, so then we look at to what degree does this minority partner have a stake in the business or have a voice in the business, like Rav Moshe had said. So you look in source one, says, "V'yimah mother shochever b'alim manios api alacha kineus daiti einim v'balosim shabalim manios a directorin or a mankal that umishum kach ein isur b'alim manios that the shareholders do not have any isur kasher chever machzika chametz b'pesach if they own chametz on Pesach you're fine omechalel Shabbos or they violate Shabbos v'chenu dim miyachas shad divrei Torah everything are perfectly fine the only thing that they can't do is steal." So he says, yes, stealing would be prohibited, even if there's no actual ownership, but I don't think you can get away with that. He's saying this across the board. But I think that opinion, it's like something that's good to store in the back of your mind if you're in a very bidyeved dire situation, but I don't think it's really been accepted by the majority of poskim. I think of Moshe's opinion. Has basically been the one that has been accepted, and everyone understands if it's a publicly traded company, and you're just a shareholder that you walked into the warehouse and said, "I'd like some of the chametz that I own," they like either laugh at you or call the police or something. You're not really going to be viewed as having any ownership over the actual items of the company. That's the source.
And if the CEO would be Jewish, and he's getting profits. I mean, he's going to get direct profits because of bonuses and things like that.
That's not necessarily an ownership share per se. I don't think it's necessary. But if he has an ownership share, it could be a different story. Now, if you, and there might be other concerns, which is that whenever there's an Isser Hanah, like with Chometz, you can't do things that would on Pesach itself that would indicate like a Rotze B'Kiyumo. That you have an interest and a desire for the chametz to remain in the world. Like you rented out an oven and the oven is going to not be viable unless the non-Jew cooks the chametz in the oven on a regular basis, then otherwise it's going to fall apart. The Shulchan Aruch has a case like this. So therefore, in order that the oven not break when it's being used, so you want the chametz, you want the non-Jew to use it with chametz, so that would be a problem, rotze b'kiyumo, for something that you want to happen on Pesach itself. So there are questions about, not the Dunkin' Donuts case, you have the Jewish pizza owners, because they do really good business on Motzei Shabbos, so they buy a lot of pizza dough before Pesach, and they sell it all. But they kind of want that pizza dough to be around so it could be bought back after Pesach. So is that a problem with Rotze B'Kiyuma? So a lot of Terutzim as to why it's not a problem. Certainly one of them is that the person's not doing anything over Pesach itself. They bought it before Pesach. And secondly, if the non-Jew decides they're gonna pay for whatever is considered to be the value of it, so the Jewish owner who sold it before Pesach would be perfectly happy not to buy it back if the non-Jew is going to pay whatever the market value. So there are different explanations as to why you're not going to have a Rotze B'Kiyumo problem. But if you're a CEO, you could have a Rotze B'Kiyumo problem that you would have to deal with over Pesach. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan indicates, that's a source 5 over here, Siman Tav Mem Ches, which is the Siman that deals with the problem of Chametz Sheavo Lav Pesach. He says, one thing you can do, he talks about a business where you have lots of animals, the animals need to be fed chametz. He says, what you could do, you could sell them all, you could sell the entire business, Yisusim, Behemoth, Sahoskim, Behesek, You can sell them to a non-Jew, just like you're selling your chometz, you can sell your business assets to the non-Jew as well. So this becomes very relevant when it comes to what is the solution for this problem. But Moshe Feinstein had a sort of a bold shita when it came to supermarkets selling chometz. He said, well, let's say the supermarket sold its chometz and it's owned by Jews, and now during Pesach, 10% of the chometz inventory is sold to customers over the course of Pesach. So he said, it doesn't mean the sale was invalid. The sale was a valid sale, it's just that the owner stole 10% of the chometz away from the non-Jewish purchaser. But for the other 90% of chometz that remained on the shelves of the store, why would they want the sale not to be valid with respect to that chometz? We're not talking about people who are mumar lahakis, that they're out to anger and to rebel against the Kodesh Baruch Hu. If they can fulfill the mandate of not owning the chometz over Pesach, so they're happy to do so. Maybe they'll succumb to the temptation to steal back some of the chometz if they can make a profit on whatever is going to be sold. But the rest of it, whatever, when the Jewish purchaser comes back into the store after Pesach is over and there's something on the shelf that wasn't sold, that wasn't sold during Pesach, so we can assume that the sale to the non-Jew of that item before Pesach was perfectly valid. Now it's been bought back only after Pesach, and then you can buy that item. But Rav Moshe says in a separate tshuva that even though he holds that way, and there were plenty of poskim who didn't hold this way, it's based on a Maharam Shik and certain other shitas that say that no, if the person who sold the chometz is then engaged in the business of dealing with chometz over Pesach, so we assume that the whole sale was a giant sham, it was a harama ha nikaris, and then it would not be considered to be good. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach came around, that's the Halikah Shlomo in Source 11, in Pesach, Perek Vav, Sif Tes, and he really held very much like Rav Moshe Feinstein. He said, no, it doesn't matter if the person didn't keep a mitzvah, but nonetheless, we assume that whatever was sold to the non-Jew is considered to be a valid sale. And he bases it on a Noda B'Yehuda, who says that if you are not a Jew, sold their chometz, for example, to a non-Jew, or any other kind of a skora, and they have in mind, I'm not going to give the key. I'm not going to give the key to the non-Jew, and I'm not going to let the non-Jew access any of the merchandise, but then the non-Jew sues him in court and says, look, we signed a valid bill of sale that you're selling all of this to me, and he wants to force the Jew to hand over the merchandise. Who wins the case in court? The non-Jew wins the case in court. So therefore, says the Noda B'Yehuda, it doesn't matter if the person has nefarious intentions, it's still considered to be a valid sale. Shlomo Zalman Orbach says the same thing over here. Now, in order to apply that argument, you would have to really ask yourself, would the non-Jew be able to force the sale or enforce the terms of the sale in court? Well, we really do try to do belt and suspenders. We have a very serious, long legal document through which the chometz is sold. We have lots of kinyonim. You come and watch the Mechiras chometz that we do here at Kins 2 days before Pesach, on Erev Pesach in the morning. A lot of kinyonim. Money is handed over. We have a handshake. We have a kinyan chalipin. We lease property and transmit the chometz through the lease of the premises as well. We do kinyan agam, another form of acquiring chometz through the lease of property. We have the actual contract, which is signed, is given over to the non-Jew. So I think that it's pretty ironclad. It's pretty bulletproof that it's something that really potentially could be enforced. It's a bigger question when you have a liquor company that's selling its liquor and they're not necessarily selling it to somebody who's licensed to buy it in accordance with all of the prescriptions of the law. Could that person who's now buying the liquor enforce the terms of the sale? That I'm not as sure about. If you're going to insist upon the Noda B'Yehuda standard, so maybe that's a question mark, unless the shtar itself has said that it's enforceable not in secular court, but it's enforceable by a Beis Din, and then the Beis Din might enforce the sale, and then it would just be a question as to whether a secular court would void the decision of the Beis Din as being against public policy, which might, you know, also neutralize or jettison that particular solution. However, these would be considerations according to Noda B'Yehuda. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's not a question as to whether it can be enforced. It's a question of what's the mindset of this Jew who presumably is not a rebel against God, that at least with respect to whatever chometz is not going to be transacted as merchandise on Pesach itself, we assume that the Jewish seller, would still want the sale to be 100% valid. But even Rav Moshe Feinstein points out that doesn't mean that the local hashgacha agency tells people that after Pesach you could buy from the supermarket. Why not? So he says, because there's another little problem, which is that in addition to the chumash that was sold before Pesach, but still sitting on the shelves and wasn't sold to a non-Jewish, wasn't sold to whomever the purchases were over the course of a Pesach, where the sale was violated, at least with respect to those items, there's another problem, which is that there presumably are new chametz items that come in during Pesach. And the new chametz items that come in during Pesach, certainly were not subject to the sale of chametz. And when you go to the store after Pesach to buy, you don't know necessarily, unless you can figure it out, if what you're buying was something that was sitting on the shelf before Pesach began, and therefore was part of the sale, whether it was something that came in during Pesach. So he said, definitely, if you're the rav of the city, the kashrus agency, you should facilitate the sale so that you can save this Jewish owner of the supermarket in whole or in significant part from violating Bayirot. Uba, you must say, but you can't give your Gishpanka to endorse the Jewish community from buying chumetz from the supermarket after Pesach is over, because you don't know whether some of the merchandise was merchandise that came in during Pesach that was not part of the sale. So how do you resolve this? You go back to the Aruch HaShulchan. Aruch HaShulchan says that there's a possibility of selling not only the chumetz, but also selling the business. So what the CRC came up with over the course of the last number of years, we sort of devised a policy of what to do with these types of companies. Like, for example, we had a pretzel company in Wisconsin that said to us that yes, that of course they would sell their CRC or Shkacha, of course they wanted to sell the chumetz, but they would not be able to function in the market if they didn't stay open during Pesach. They were not from people per se, and they said, we have to figure out a way to keep our business open during Pesach. So what are we going to do as the CRC? So he said, okay, we have to do two things. Number one, you have to sell your chumetz. Like all the companies under the CRC have to sell their chumetz, 100%. But number two, you also have to sell the business. But when you sell the business, it has to be a very real sale, because there would be much more of a concern regarding voiding the sale if it was clear that it was insincere. Because in the case of you selling chumetz, you could say, yeah, the person is happy to sell whatever chumetz is just going to sit around during Pesach anyway, so that the owner of the store is not going to violate, at least with that chumetz, bayirah bayimatzah. When it came to the sale of a company, this was actually something which, according to those who were close to Rav Moshe Feinstein, specifically where he saw Belsky, Zatzal said that Rav Moshe Feinstein wasn't comfortable with this, with those who would not take it seriously, because there it's much more of a haram and ikaris. You're going to sell a business and continue to operate the business, so clearly you haven't sold anything. Then you can't say, oh, deep down the person intended to sell the business. No, they didn't sell. Either you sell the business and you stay out of the operations, or you didn't sell the business. So take a look at source 12 on page 4. So this is a letter from Rav Eli Gerstmann, who's the official kashrus researcher, writer, a wonderful Talmid Chacham for the OU, that he wrote to Speaker Reisman. Speaker Reisman was writing a piece about, can you buy chumetz items from, help me out here, James Richardson or something? That's the store that's in the Tel Aviv airport that was apparently for a long time owned by Jews. I don't think it's necessarily now. It might be more publicly traded. Yeah, but at one point in time, it was considered under Jewish ownership, and they sold the chumetz, but the store remained open, apparently, over Pesach. So what's the story with that? So he was writing a very learned piece about that. So he wrote this letter to Speaker Reisman explaining the opinion of Yisrael Belsky, and this is all written up in Reisman's Sefer Ratzkitz Tzvi. He says, when Moshe Don, Binyan Mechivas Matzvei Chometz, but Moshe Feinstein dealt with this whole issue of the store that remains open. So it's Benigun the Mechivas Ha'esek Kula, but he didn't talk about selling the entire business. So why didn't he talk about selling the entire business? Benogela Esek Kula, Arishabalam Eno Meunyan Mechivas Ha'esek, because he said that if the owners are clearly going to be involved in running the business during Pesach, so then clearly the whole thing is a complete fraud. There's no gemiras das whatsoever when we see that they're still actively involved in the running of the business, so that's why he didn't get involved in that. But if you could make it work that the people are not involved in the running of the business, so then you solve the problem even of the chometz that comes in during Pesach, because any chometz that comes in or is produced during Pesach is completely under the ownership of the non-Jew, if you can make it work. So therefore, we established a protocol with four different conditions for the sale of the business. Condition number one, the Jewish owner can't have anything to do with the business over Pesach. So for example, we sell every single year the chometz of a major liquor manufacturer here. here in Chicago, and we always sit down with the owner and we say, where are you going away for Pesach? I mean, nowadays it's hard to like really ensure that a person won't be involved in the. It used to be that being involved in a business meant you actually showed up and you're sitting in your office, but now like the entire universe is a person's office because people work remotely all the time, so it's a little bit more difficult to monitor this sort of thing, but we hope the person will go on a Pesach program. We encourage them, you know, that you'll get so tied up with all the delicious food on the Pesach program and the programming and the shows and whatever, so that hopefully that will distract you enough from being around the business. So condition number one, they can't be involved in running the business over the course of Pesach, but how can they not be involved? Who else is going to run the business? So condition number two is the non-Jew who buys the business has to be a non-Jew who's like an active manager in the business, who's capable of running the business himself or herself. So we always make sure that we have such an individual who is the purchaser of the business. I mean, one of the problems that I faced when I got here was I discovered that one of the businesses we had the chometz sold and the business sold for Pesach was one where it was being sold to the spouse of the Jewish owner of the business. His wife was not Jewish, and she was the one who was buying it. And I said, well, we have a problem there, because according to Dina de Malchusa, whatever kind of marital assets that she has, the husband has an automatic stake in the marital assets. So I changed the contract in that particular case to say that the husband was disavowing any right to any legal right that he might have to the assets of the company, despite the fact that they might otherwise be considered marital assets under the law. But I was extremely uncomfortable with that. It goes without saying. And thank goodness that the business has since been sold, so we don't have to deal with that particular problem. Yes, Rabbi Biber.
When they sell it to the the manager is a non-Jew, right? Mm-hmm. Is he then told he cannot contact the owner for any decision?
Yeah, we say to this person, you're going to have to run the business yourself, and that the Jewish owner is completely out of it over the course of Pesach. Do we require that there be a policy where we're going to investigate and make sure that there was no conversation that took place between them over Pesach? Probably not. But it's not necessarily usher for them to have a conversation. What's usher is for the Jewish owner really to to be the decision maker of the company during this period of time. Correct. And if you take a look,
the third and fourth criteria.
Oh, the third and fourth criteria. So the third and fourth criteria are, we need to see an expense and income statement regarding all of the revenue over the course of Pesach, how much was spent on expenses and how much revenue came in, so that we can figure out exactly what the profit was that was earned over the course of Pesach, and they have to share that income statement with us at the conclusion of Pesach, and then we need to see the check, ideally the canceled check that was cut from the person who had been the owner of the business to the non-Jew who owned the business over the course of Pesach, showing that the non-Jewish purchaser actually received the profits of the business during Pesach. Now, can I guarantee that after they receive that, do I know what they do with the money and whether they decide to give it as a gift to somebody? That a person can do whatever they want with the money that they receive. We prefer that they keep the money, and we make a big emphasis and play over the fact that it's your money. Do whatever you want. We hope the business is spectacularly successful and you'll be able to go out on a big vacation from all the money you make over Pesach. But at the very least, we need to see that the money was handed over in terms of the profits over Pesach. So conditions 3 and 4. You look at the Shiloh situation.
Gerrymander the price to be net profits minus $100.
No, it has to be real, meaning it has to
that's
be...
That's a real price.
Okay.
I'm going to make $1 million. I'm willing to pay $950,000 or
$990,000. Oh, so talking in terms of the price that's paid for the purchase of the business. It's very difficult. You're 100% right. You're 100% right. But we don't want it to be like a haram and carry. Sometimes when people engage in sort of like a star Shabbos, they sell the business for Shabbos, they do it in such a way in which they almost guarantee it's always going to be a wash. And if it's always going to be washed, why is somebody buying the business altogether and going through the trouble of running the business? Therefore, to me, that's a giant haram, and we don't allow that sort of thing. So we require that the business be purchased for a very small sum of money, and that the person, because if this business, this Jewish owner, really feels that the business is going to tank unless it's open during Pesach, fine, but don't make any money off of it. Don't make any money off of it. Let the non-Jew buy the business for a nominal amount, so at least you're not going to lose anything because the business will continue to function, but let the non-Jew earn the profits during that period of time. If you want to be certified by the CRC, that's kind of the way that we require you to do it. But you're 100% right. You could try to calibrate the price in such a way so that the profit would be more minimal. Yes?
How much of Pesach is an Issud Rabbanim? After Pesach, when I go to the shelf and I see a can of food, and it's certainly not clear, is this can from before Pesach including the sale or not? We have a Suffolk Rabbanim Lekula situation. Why we're going to be selling businesses now to avoid problems of a Suffolk Rabbanim Lekula situation afterwards?
Yes, and also so that those who are certified by the CRC are not going to be over Averis over the course of Pesach if they're Jewish owned.
Oh, so it's not because the customer, when you said we don't recommend.
No, but it's also for the customer. It's also for the customers because here we are machmir. Unless if you have a rove, with respect to a particular item at a certain point, that it definitely is not from the shovel of a Pesach, so then there's more room to be made. Well, take a look at the Mishnah Berurah. So generally speaking, he would require that there be at least a probability that what you're buying after Pesach is something which is not Chumash. I mean, it's very difficult, or it's not something that was Chumash that was owned by a Jew during Pesach. Sometimes it's very difficult because you could have a store that's owned by non-Jews, and then there are distributors of items, of a major distributors in the country who are Jewish-owned, and even if the store is itself not problematic, you can't vouch for all the items that are in the store that come from the Jewish distributor. So we try our best to also check out all the distributors and facilitate sales by the distributors, especially long-standing items like liquor, which can be around for years and years after they've been manufactured, and we try to facilitate sales of the major distributors. But all we can do is do our best and to try to reduce the situation to a situation where at least you can rely upon rove. That's why in many communities the Rabbanim will say, okay, based on the shelf life that's anticipated with respect to most items, you can start buying chametz again from a store that was owned by a Jew that didn't sell the chametz or didn't sell the chametz properly or ideally. You can start buying again after Lag BaOmer or after Shavuos because we figure out what's sort of a reasonable amount of time to wait in order to rely upon this.
If the profit's going to be like fairly big, and there may be hesitancy, if you're selling it to a vice president, is it possible to tell to have understand the vice president usually gets a big bonus in January? Can you say this is in lieu of the big bonus? We're making you a partner this week.
It has to be that, and this is something that's also relevant when you have a Shtar Shabbos situation, it has to be that whatever amount is being received is over and above whatever are the person's other salary amounts of what they normally earn and so forth, because if it's just basically that you say, oh, you're entitled to this amount anyway, and we're just going to give you this amount from here as opposed to from somewhere else, so then the truth of the matter is that they're not really getting anything. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in Chelek Dalet Siman Tzadi Vav in Or HaChaim, in which he says that when you do sort of reach the point that you have the rove, that you have sort of the majority to rely upon, so then there's a room to be made. But we do sort of require at least that you have that point in time in which you have a majority presumption that it's no longer going to be chametz she'av olav ha'pesach. It's just the way, the nature of the way that this particular takana is applied. It's true, it's a din d'rabbanan, it's a knas d'rabbanan, it's a knas d'rabbanan that's applicable to everybody, and it is subject to certain stringencies that you wouldn't necessarily always expect.
So after Pesach, when the vice president is selling the company back to the Jew, right?
Mm-hmm. So let me talk about that. That's a very good question. So I was about to mention the Karen LeDavid, which is Rav Eliezer Greenwald from Charna, who also spoke about exactly what the criteria are for the sale of a business. That's source 13 on page 4. He says that if the person's osig boko yimoso payasak adam sheosib bishalo, and then it's considered like the individual is reacquiring whatever chametz had been sold. So a very important criteria is to make sure that whatever involvement or conversations the seller of the business is going to have, they can't deal with the business as if they're the owner of the business. So, you know, they have an expertise. You want to call them up and say, oh, I'm having an employment problem, an employee, how do you generally handle this? Okay, it might be a different story, but to actually be running the business, so that's what would be particularly problematic when it comes to these sales. Now, there is a big difference. You asked about the buyback of the business. One of the things that we discovered with a couple of the places or a couple of the authorities where they were involved in these types of sales is that they would do a mechira lizman. Meaning, that's how you would typically sell something, let's say, over a Shabbos. You sell your business over Shabbos, or leasing it out, so you lease it out from shortly before Shabbos until shortly after Shabbos. You don't need a buyback, because it's just that there's an expiration of the time period. So you can do that. We do that when we lease out the property on which Chometz is located. It's only a leasing lizman, from shortly before Pesach until right after Pesach. You don't need to lease it back, because the lease itself can be for a set period of time. The Chometz, however, the chometz has to be sold permanently, because if you only have a sale of chometz lizman, this is discussed in the Sefer Mechiras Chometz Kehilchoso, then that might not count as a proper sale of chometz, because when it comes to chometz, if I only sell it for a period of time, it might be that I'm maintaining a kinyan haguf, and I'm only selling a kinyan hapeos, in which case I still have ownership. Or the fact that it's coming back to me is called what's known as davar hagorim lemamon. It's going to lead to a monetary benefit down the road for me, and davar hagorim lemamon is considered kimamon dami for purposes of owning chometz. It's considered like I still own the chometz. So therefore, what we really need to have is two different sale documents. One is a sale of the chometz itself, which is a permanent, absolute, unconditional sale. And if there isn't a buyback, then the non-Jew continues to own the chametz. And one is a sale of the company, which is a temporary sale, only for a period of time. So what we discovered with one of the documents that was being utilized in connection with sale of Jewish interest in a particular supermarket is that there was only one document, and it was a sale of Zman for a period of time, including the chometz. So that becomes very problematic, because then it could be that even though you can sell the business lizman, but you can't just sell the chometz lizman, then it's considered like the chometz itself never really left the possession of the Jewish owner. So we did ask this person, or this very, very esteemed, distinguished, very fine rav, if this particular tweak could be made in the document, which he said he would make in the document. But this is one of the things that we monitor at the CRC and that we're involved in, just to make sure that this standard is followed across the board, because everybody really is affected. When you have a giant supermarket chain, you have a giant distributor of liquor, whatever it is, everybody is going to be affected by the way the sale is conducted. So this is the way in which we have articulated that the sale should take place. And I've seen that there are a number of Rabbanim and other kashrus agencies that are following the same sort of protocol, but this is our protocol. So what we do is two separate sales. One is an absolute sale of the chometz, and the other is a sale of the company lizman. And because we generally will meet with the companies a week or two before Pesach even begins, we have to do a sale with a chalos. The effective date of the sale is only going to the best at a later point in time, and that creates other complications, because there are certain kinyanim where the kinyan is not going to be valid anymore if, for example, you give over a suda, you do a kinyan chalifin, and the person who is the purchaser gives over a handkerchief or a pen to the person who's the seller picks it up and thereby transfers the chometz. But if he gives the pen or the handkerchief back to the purchaser afterwards, so that's what you normally do when you have a kinyan chalifin, but that's only if the sale takes place at that point in time. The sale was meant to vest later on, then we have a principle known as kolsa kinyano. It's considered like, well, the kinyan has already come to an end, but before the time that it's vested. So we always tell the people, well, in this case, come with a lot of pens, because there are a lot of things that are going to be transferred. But the seller is going to have to keep the pens until after Pesach in this particular case, until at least until the sale vests. Yes.
Quick question, because we're coming to an end, and this has been on my mind for a long time. When someone sells a business and they're serving trades, like some of the nursing homes, they're selling their personal chametz and their business chametz, but they're serving chametz and they're still owning the nursing home during that time. How does that work as far as halacha for those owners?
They're selling their chametz.
They're selling their chametz. Right. I'm selling my personal chametz. I'm selling my business chametz, right. But I'm okay. Still owning my nursing home. My nursing home is serving chametz to the people who are living in the nursing home.
So the way that it's recommended to do with the nursing homes is that all the chametz, all the food, it should be owned by the management company which is operating the nursing home, so that there's never really an ownership of the chametz by the owner itself, and that it's all being dealt with, all the food ownership and distribution and hiring, firing food employees, all of that is being done by the management company, and you're simply paying the management company to do their job. That's what's recommended. There's a wonderful sefer called, I think, Commerce in Forbidden Foods or something by Rabbi Yosef Kushner, who's the son-in-law of Rabbi Shlomo Miller from Toronto, which he comes up with this suggestion from his shver. And he gives you all of the protocols and the formulas of exactly how this should work. Okay, we're going to skip over the next two items, which has to do with common questions of how you kosher things for Pesach. If you want, in terms of any special heterim of koshering a kalim, that you're supposed to wait 24 hours after the last use of the kli if you're going to kosher it for Pesach, and I speak about how sometimes there might be room for leniency if it's the Erev Pesach and you can't wait 24 hours, because even though we're machmir to the opinion that chometz is considered isur obala, that it's an isser, and therefore you need to make sure you have shishin times, 60 times to knock out the isser, we probably say with respect to chometz before Pesach that even if it's isur obala, we don't say chaticha nases nevela, in which case, and I don't have time to go into all of the details, but it could be that, let's say, that I have a very large kli that I am kashering, and that the water is 8 times the amount of the volume of the walls of the kli, so I assume that 1/8 of then is going to go back into the kli afterwards, so if I just did hagola a second time, I would only have a 1/64th measure the second time around, and that would work. Something you could read at greater length in the article that I wrote in this volume about the Yosef, so I highly recommend that. I was going to discuss the kashering of frying pans, but the basic rule is that frying pans were worried that you didn't use with a lot of oil, and therefore you have to kasher with libun, at least when it comes to chametz, even though there are opinions that are more lenient. The last thing I wanted to mention is the CRC policy regarding quinoa. What is the CRC policy regarding quinoa come from? We hold that quinoa is not considered to be a problem of kidneys. Why not? The Ramah brings sort of this minhag to stay away from kidneys in Siman Tov Nun Gimel from minhag Ashkenaz, and he says that this is, even though it's not an issur chametz, but where does it come from? Mishnah Berurah explains that maybe we're worried that items that are kidneys are items where, like legumes, like rice, for example, is kidneys. You can make into flour, so it's similar to like wheat flour, or in the case of legumes, that it grows in areas where there might be wheat particles that are growing nearby, and the wheat particles might get mixed in. So Moshe Feinstein said, so what about peanuts? You can make peanut flour and so forth, should we also be mocking about that? And he said, no, because if we were going to be mocking for anything that satisfied the concerns regarding kidneys, then we would have outlawed potatoes. The Chayyadim wanted to outlaw potatoes, and people said he shouldn't call his sefer the Chayyadim, he should call it the Misas Adam. Right?
It did not go over well.
They did not end up because people needed to have their potatoes. So Moshe said whatever wasn't originally included in the minhag is not included, so he thought the peanuts should be okay. So if you look at the very last source on page 9, which shows that I'm serious about understanding, when the Bata Yosef says, if a Shadim Achon is done or posting him kinwa, who the cloud kidney is? Is kinwa included or not? So Rav Shechter Shlita, Haven Shachlolo Shagrom Hagon of Moshe Feinstein or Geagam Makinwa, it applies to Kinwa too. Makimish or Nikla, but Minak Shinogu may have shown him since it wasn't included. They didn't have Kinwa in Europe. It wasn't included in what they were gozer upon. Therefore, Havadlolosipala, it's not upon us to start asking more things, and therefore you can have your Kinwa. And that's the policy of the CRC, Gedalia Dov Schwartz. Followed that, he was a very intrepid spirit. When people were nervous what to do about quinoa, said Rav Schwartz, I'm going to matzah quinoa. And the OU said, oh, well, in that case, we're going to be matzah quinoa too. I mean, afterwards. However, Rav Agon, also my Rebbe, Rav Willig, Mala v'kihila, so he tells his kehila, according to the Bata Yosef, she'en l'chol kinwa, don't eat kinwa b'Pesach, she'a she'eshid most of the bonim, even though it's similar to peanuts, who here is eating peanuts on Pesach? Harikvar nagrish l'chol bonim b'Pesach. You see that they didn't follow Rav Moshe in the end. People did not eat peanuts on Pesach. L'chein hu adzien b'kinwa, to which I would simply respond. Right, so I would say, in addition to this principle of havdala lo sipa la, we have ala rishonim anu mitzdarim. Say, okay, so peanuts somehow got dragged in, but we don't have to do the same with respect to quinoa. So unlike the case of peanuts, quinoa has become more widespread to be mako, but you still need to have proper certification to make sure the quinoa that you eat. I'm sorry,
that, yep. I believe that the quinoa is viewed as being kidney.
Yeah, but here in America, at least, we have been able to save the day thus far with respect to quinoa, but when you buy it, you do have to make sure that it's properly certified, so that this quinoa, in fact, has been carefully vetted, that there is no chametz that is mixed in. Okay, we're over the time. And we'll end here. I want to wish everybody a good question.
There's a few. There's a couple more hours in the king's closet.